Welcome, everyone, to the eighth talk, only two more after this evening, and I want to approach this talk by reading the placard, as usual. So this eighth talk is both the ox and the person forgotten, and it says under the graphic, whip, rope, person and bull all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can sustain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors. I have abandoned the whip and the ropes. So what do I say to that? I think the poem was worth the price of admission. And as I was working today on this talk, and I had some elaborate theme, and about an hour before I was to come, maybe an hour and a half, I just balled it all up and threw it away. Because I'm not sure I could have understood it had I listened. It just started getting so out there. I thought, what am I doing here? It happened at that very moment that I was bowling it up. Ellen, my wife, called and asked me to put on some rice for dinner, and I was extremely upset that she interrupted my... I can't give her, how can I have time? I don't have time for rice. So I kind of pared it down, but I don't want it to be abstract. I want the concepts to be grounded. And I want it to be, so what I think I'm going to do is to do a very short talk. Just some general points. And then we're going to sit for 2 or 3, 4 minutes and see what discussion or questions might come up from that, which can ground it. Because, see, we're missing the discussion night. The discussion night, for those of you who come, you know how it grounds the talk into your life, into the purpose of your life. Those who don't perhaps haven't seen these talks and know how they can be grounded. But if we get too far out there, and Zen has a way of just kind of casting us off into the stratosphere. You know, basically, we're talking about the limitation of thought. I mean, we can approach Dharma in several different directions, but I think it's worthwhile. You know, the quieter we become, the more whole in ourselves we appear. The equation is very simple. Quiet breeds sanity, presence, wholeness of mind, orientation. Buoyancy, joy. And chit-chat, mental chit-chat, does just the opposite. That's basically what all this is talking about. We learn how to be quiet with ourselves. We start off not knowing why we should be quiet to ourselves, or not even knowing that we're noisy, which is amazing, that we can live with that ruckus for the number of years that we do. And never have any sense that it is out of control. And it takes only a minute to sit down and say to yourself, I want to be quiet and see that you can't. But most of us never face that minute of self-discovery. Often prior to coming to meditation, when that's the point. And then that sort of sets the backdrop to everything, because nothing can pierce the noise. Our hearts are held in abeyance to the sounds we create. It's as if we say continually in some way or some permutation or some combination, we are continually saying, again, this should not be happening. This should not be happening. I shouldn't have a family. I shouldn't have this body. I shouldn't have this mind. My life should be any variation of the theme. And there are as many variations as there are incidences. Simply shuts us down, closes us off, closets us from any sense of connection whatsoever. This should not be happening. Now, come back into the closet. We've closed the door. This should not be happening. Door slammed. We are now in the darkened closet of our own righteous perception. This should not be happening. Feel what it's like inside that closet. We are literally the thickness of the door away from everything. Our heart can't touch and has no access to any aliveness because we have shut down the possibility that life could be or should be any other way than our demands. End of story. This should not be happening. And the heart's the thing that suffers. Compassion can't leak out there. Many of us get involved with our service work with the idea that this injustice should not be happening, that this homelessness should not be happening, that this abuse, this on and on, absolutely should not be happening. And so we think we're getting involved with it through our hearts, but our hearts can't possibly find any exposure when we have shut down the very mechanism of connectedness through which the heart is nourished. All possibilities have ended for connection. A mature meditator never says that. And perhaps that should have been the homework. How many times this week do you seal your life off, hermetically seal your life off from any sense of exposure to anything that's alive and nourishing by forming that conclusion or one of the many themes that says the same thing? What we're left with is our mental turbulence in a sense of kind of an inward tantrum where I can't have my way. It's really an inward tantrum. Meditation. Let's look at meditation from that simple context. Because the problem is this. The problem is that we have stepped back in disfavor of circumstances. And in that protracted stepping back comes the space to offer censorship or commentary or judgment or disdain. It's that stepping back and reflecting upon what is happening that causes that brief momentary gap between ourselves and everything in the world. That moment that allows the reflected commentary to come in and to say, this should not be happening. It also sets us up to feel as if, it seems as if, all of life is coming narrowed down through the corridor of me. It's like all senses, all, even when a bird sings, it's coming in this way. It's like I'm at the vortex of all experiences. That sense that the sense of I is the center stage of it all. We know that one, right? And we don't seem to be able to get off center stage. And we try everything. Because never realizing that most of our efforts force us back on the center stage. We don't realize that our very efforts to get off the center stage is exactly what forces that perspective to be gained. So we get into meditation. We sit down and see the problem. Oh, the mind just won't shut up. And then we attempt to nudge it into shutting up. And we try everything. We hear the instructions that says you're not supposed to effort your way and quiet the mind, but it doesn't matter because that's the problem. We see it. We hear it. We can't shut it up. It's not under our control. And so there must be some way, some technique, something to smother it. Because this should not be happening. And the crucial point there is that the effort to shut it up is more noise and reactivity creating and burning a hotter fire of the very raucous, combustible flame of the noise. And somehow, we think of ourselves as sort of being outside, sort of looking in at the noise, and that since we're outside, we should be able to do some kind of control, have some kind of control over the noise, even if it means strangling it. I mean, you know, we can wrap our arms around this thing. We can do a lot of... And so, our efforts, even though... Again, the instructions are so different than where we place our efforts. It's really to put distance, more distance, between ourselves and this disturbance. So in the beginning, we're actually creating more of the gap, more of the commentary, more of the resistance, more of the angst that was the inherent and is the inherent problem to begin with. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And we carry, and so the way this Vipassana, insight meditation, works is that we carry within us the watcher. We like to take a little bit of ourselves with us into the meditation. So, this sense of watcher has a built-in commentary, has a built-in critique, censorship, and even though the watcher, the awareness, is supposed to be non-judgmental, doesn't stop the watcher. It's mumbling the entire time, complaining or whatever, reacting to whatever it is that's going on. Every once in a while shutting up, but not for very long. And infusing that same sense of distance that we had, that we saw as the problem, back into the meditation, which is to solve the problem. Just continue jabber on and on. And that commentator sizes up where we're going, says, oh, I think I'm getting somewhere. Or I don't think I'm getting anywhere. Well, this is frustrating. Other people are doing it better than me. Constantly seeing itself in comparison, in measurement, in abstraction to everything that's going on. That is the problem. There is no other problem. There isn't some way to circumnavigate this problem and get over the problem until we see that that is the problem. Nothing happens. Nothing happens. You can have good samadhi. You can have great, I don't know, you name it. But nothing happens, not in terms of your spiritual growth, not until we see the real problem at hand. Not until we actually look and say, my God, eureka! I am the problem. The sense of I is the problem. And I've been carrying the I with me wherever I go. I can't lose the I because when I try to, I reinforce the I. I can't shut the I up because when I try to, the muffled sound of my speech is what I hear. What can I do? Please tell me. And perhaps that's the first sign of humility that we've ever had in our meditation. Please, I'm helpless. Somebody. And at that point, we are totally defeated. And we have to become defeated. We have to, this practice has to defeat us. And some of us haven't been defeated quite sufficiently yet. We've lost half our army, but by God, we have some reserve troops. Total defeat. Despair in some ways, some people's despair. I can't do anything about this. It's not in my power. It's not in my power to do anything about this. And much of Dharma is meant to show us that try as we will, our suffering, externally or internally, is created when we do try to do something about it. When we have expectations or imaginations, or we try to occur control over what is happening, that control ultimately backfires into some sense of pain in ourselves. And when we become humble enough, we begin to say, oh my God, I'm beginning to get this now. I'm not conscious enough. More humility. I realize that I'm not conscious enough. That the unconscious sense of who I am keeps playing forth in conditioned response, and I'm not conscious enough of that unconditioned part of me to be like any inroads into this at all. Now, in that total honest admission that both we are helpless and that there are workings back there that are not being seen, we now have our orientation in correct direction to work effectively in the direction that this practice is meant to go. But instead of now creating more noise when something arises, we get quieter. We realize that the antidote to the sense of me is not a robust yell and shout. We've been shouting our way through life. Nor is it this should not be happening, which is a counter and anxious presentation to the problem. It is simply the willingness to be quiet. The quieter we become, the more we see. The quieter we become, said differently, the more conscious we become. Because the noise, when the noise was in full volume, we thought we knew exactly what the problem was and exactly the indication of what needed to be done. The quieter we become, we see that we don't know. Not only don't we know, we have no idea how to end this noise. In fact, even the idea of ending ends. But we get very interested. The quieter we become, the more conscious we become, the more interest arises in what is in front of us. Isn't this, look how this thing works. Suddenly, the mechanism that was working so far against us has now become an intricate examination of what is happening to make it seem as if the sense of me is so real and the sense of everything else lies outside in some kind of dualistic, distant way. How could that be? We say to ourselves. How could that be? We say that as a way to invite not that this shouldn't be happening, but a quiet examination of the processes of what is happening. What is happening here? Not with an attempt to end it, because that's not looking at something. When we have the idea that this needs to be ended, then we have the idea that this is a momentary difficulty that needs to be surmounted and I need to move on. But this is the whole of the journey itself. That willingness to look, to see, to understand directly, not through thinking. That's why we have to be very quiet. Because if we think about the problem, all we get back is what we've already known about the problem. It's as if we just hear the echoes of our own voice coming back, our own opinions, our own ideas. That's all that there's nothing new that can be seen through the knowledge that we bring to the problem. So we have to be very quiet with the problem. And the quieter we become, the more the problem opens in its newness, in its complete simplicity. We get to the point, and this is where the circle, and this is what I was going to spend an hour talking about, and I'm it's going to be mentioned in passing. That in some spiritual practices, as we get quieter and we have less resistance to the experience at hand, we make less and less out of that experience, right? Because we're not bringing anything to it. We realize that the experience only has meaning and purpose and made into something from the words that we give it and offer it. I know what this is. I've had a history and relationship with it. I reflect upon it. I have a whole understanding of it. I'm bringing that knowledge to it. It in itself does not hold that knowledge. So if I get quiet, that knowledge no longer embraces the experience, and the experience then opens up into wonder. As the experience opens up into wonder, the sense of I that held the knowledge about that experience and is no longer bringing that knowledge forth also opens up into wonder. Wonder meets wonder. No object, no subject. Thought streaming ends. No thingness. No thing seen, no one seen. For the first time, we realize that this thing does end. That it has an ending. Before, it's just been like Looney Tunes, continuously in front of us, jabbering. And we hear that it could possibly end, but we thought stream our way through the gaps in everyone's day in which it does end. And so since we pick up the tune on the other side of the ending, we just think the tune carried us right on through. The tune of I. But there is a practice, there is the experience, or the lack of experience, there is the happening within the event, however you want to say it, no word actually, in which subject and object ends. And it's an important, although not essential. It is an important demarcation for the meditator, because no longer is there any question that how the self arises in relationship to something else, that the self is not continuous, and that it rises in relationship to the experience it sees. And if there's any grasping in relationship to that experience, then the self will continue, and so will the experience. And as soon as there's no grasping in relationship to that experience, there's no experience and no self having it. And that's the dynamic. And that the whole world of self and other is literally one concept deep. Now, why do I say that it's important but not essential? Well, it's important because it shows irreversibly the ending and the relative nature of the beginning. And it shows irreversibly that the Dharma is true. So there's no doubt. But why do I say it's not essential? It's not essential because it's often within deeper and prolonged meditation retreating that that situation arises. There is an equally important experiential arising that happens within our daily life. We may not get to that degree of subtlety where we see self and object ending. But that doesn't mean we can't know the end of selfing ourselves in ordinary existence without deep meditative training. But what is essential for us as lay people to come to the deepest aspects of Dharma is the willingness to direct our lives in accordance with the deepest principles of Dharma. And if we keep using our practice to reinforce our sense of me, never realizing that we're even doing it, or never even wanting to know, but just kind of liking to be a meditator and enjoying kind of hanging out in the Sangha, then this is what we will get. There is only one reason that any of us, in essence, practices this meditation. And that, in its essence, where the Buddha was pointing, is to step out of self-delusion. And so we have to use our practice from beginning through the middle to the end, directed with that intentionality. And if that means that we have to expose those areas of ourselves that still need further nurturement because we feel diminished in some capacity and character, we have to understand that that neediness is coming from pain that is unconsciously attended to. It's not even being attended to at all, conscious or unconscious. It's being forgotten and reacted to. And we have to bring conscious attention and look at it, because this whole practice unfolds from making the unconscious conscious, the willingness to move the conscious attention and awareness into areas of darkness. Because that's where the self is formed. That is where the self hides out, you might say. Like some kind of infestation of insects. And because it becomes more and more curious to the sense of each one of us that this, something's driving this thing, and it ain't me, and I don't know what it is, but I just keep erupting into life, not smoothly. And unless I develop the intention, come what may, to go back and to unseat the unconscious and to turn it over wherever the leaf may be, to see the other side of that thing and to look at it and expose it, then this thing will forever be walking in that direction. And that's true for both the long-term practitioner who stays on retreat, the Buddhist monk or nun, or the lay practitioner who brings his or her practice to bear upon and within their daily life. Just because we've had a moment of break doesn't mean the whole thing has broken down. Believe me, it has not. And there is still an immense amount of uncovery to do within the darkened areas of our psyche that each one of us have to move into and explore to make this, to right this thing in a way so we know what we're doing to ourselves. It doesn't require some kind of prolonged psychoanalysis. It needs our intention. That's all. It's unbelievably simple. But we need to have the intention to do it. Something in us feels the urgency to look where it hasn't looked before. And it's through having seen the fact that when we don't look, we fall apart in a variety of different ways. Our life simply doesn't work from unconscious intentions or motivations. It doesn't work. It falls apart. We keep forever running up against some abrasive quality in us, some all on and on. All of us know that. We all know that in this room. We come to a point in our meditation in which we have understood the principles and strategies of how to step out of self-deception. And we have gotten very quiet within ourselves, and our intention has become keenly focused upon that and only that for our spiritual life and salvation. And as we reach a point in which the sense of self is no longer the cornerstone of all data that comes in, it's because we have uprooted through our intention, we have uprooted the need to be planted anywhere. Then there is an experience of oneness. Now, what is the experience of oneness? How does that change our meditation? Let me just brush it. I just want to... Because there's equal certainty at this point as there was back in the more refined retreat setting when there was a break in the knowing, knower, and knowing. Oneness has the same effect. It's not a fantasy of oneness. It's a direct participation within oneness. So it's not some kind of altered experience, which is very interesting, you see, since we see irreversibly positively, without question, that all things are one. Suddenly we realize that every manifestation that ever occurred, including all the different experiences we thought we had to get over, confusion, ignorance, even the sense of me, also was part of that one. That nothing could ever be outside. How could something be outside of one? Then there would be two. Nothing ever was outside of that one, nor could be outside of that one. And when that is seen, which it is, experienced, realized, which it can be, then there is no movement from any aspect of our life whatsoever in how it manifests. And that includes being lost in thought. Because being lost in thought is as perfect in that moment as any other expression of life. Now let us back up and look at all the ways that we fight ourselves. Because behind those areas are some sense of disturbance. Something that we feel we're lacking in the moment that we're trying to overcompensate for. And we get a sense of where our work needs to go. Not towards trying to overcompensate, we weren't good enough that time. But behind that, as to what it is that's encouraging the need to do that at all. It's like Adam and Eve ate the apple and fell out of the Garden of Eden. How they fell out of the Garden of Eden, is that they then had self-consciousness that they had eaten the apple. How did they know they were out of the Garden of Eden? Except because they were self-conscious of the fact that they thought they were. They had betrayed some rule. We are going in reverse order to that. We are coming back into the Garden of Eden, losing our self-consciousness. Because we never betrayed it. We thought we did. We seemed to. It didn't work. And we had to follow the tracks of the ox all the way to see that we never had to leave home in the first place. Isn't that interesting? Isn't it symmetrical? Isn't it kind of exquisite? We just thought ourselves out of place. So let's get in alignment. Let's just get in line with this thing. Use it in the way it's supposed to go. Use it in the direction we're supposed to take. Stop saying this shouldn't be happening. Why am I not on retreat? Because you're not. Why am I not a nun? Because you're not. Betray ourselves 1,000 times, and you think you're going to get closer? Join the truth of the actual experience at hand, and we are as close as we could ever be. Join our family. Don't fight it. There is no more perfect way for any of us to proceed than exactly where we are and infuse it with our presence. That's all that's necessary. But I wonder how many of you are listening. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So we're going to sit for just a few minutes, and then for questions or comments about anything. Anyone have anything they'd like to bring up? Yes. Yes.
Everything being in oneness, born in oneness.
Yes.
Then came, from where did the resistance come from?
Where does what?
Where does resistance come
from? Uh-huh. So where do you think resistance comes from? Question is about oneness and resistance, and if everything is one, where does resistance come from? Yeah. So where do you think resistance come from? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm interested in you moving into what. So where does resistance come from? Does it come from oneness, or does it come from the belief of two-ness? See, I think it's easy to find. I don't mean it to be an elusive question. But here's generally how it works. Okay, so I'm going to paint a big mind here, right? Nothing in the mind is outside of unification. But a thought arises that says, I don't like this moment. It references a moment that of similar nature that it had in the past. It was much better than this one. A better talk, or better weather, or better body, better anything. And it then says, this can be improved. That's a variation of this shouldn't be happening. Okay? This can be improved. And so then it attempts to do just that. And this is all unconscious, because if we were conscious, we would have seen that nothing in just what I have spoken arising was outside of oneness. From that perspective, nothing happened. But from the perspective of the truth of the thought, something just did happen, which was I arose and was in disagreement. If we look at what the sense of self is that has led to this sense of disagreement, we can't find anything but a thought that ended, and a feeling or a sensation that something was off, unpleasant perhaps, and I wanted it to change. And all of that led into thinking about how I was going to change. And suddenly I was on front and center stage trying to affect that change. But if we look at the moment it's actually happening, it's thinking, emotion reacting, feeling, grasping. Nothing. It all breaks down into essentially nothing, to the mechanics of nothing. Right? Each one of which were never outside of oneness to begin with. It was only when we reframed what happened in terms of a thought about what happened that it seemed to be coming from outside. Because the thought, and the nature of any thought, is that it frames life in time. So that life, and what was used to be now, is now framed in terms of a reflective glance at now, this could be better than this. Like, I'm outside looking in. This can be better. This could, I can do better than this. Right? As soon as I do that, as soon as I step out and come in with my commentary, I'm outside the moment looking in at it. You know, you just can't, you can't be a part of the moment and comment on it at the same time. Because in one, you're subjectively a part of the moment, in the other, you're objectively observing the moment. And you can't be subjective and objective at the same time, right? So we have to give up one place or the other. So most of us give up the place of abiding in the moment to have an objective observation of the moment. As soon as we do that, we have a whole list of criteria on how the moment isn't operating according to our expectation. And then we try to do something to the moment to get it moving in the direction we want it to occur. The problem is that now is not when a control occurs. If now is now. Our control says, well, I want to change the temperature. But that's the future. Now is happening now. And so control never affects now. It always affects what I want now to become. So we're always, is this, see, this is where I was going to go. And I know that all of you are glazed over. Because I was. I really wasn't. But I could feel that I was losing you. And the fact is that the explanations are endless, aren't they? You don't need all that. You just need to know where your true home is, and your heart can tell you that.
So even labeling something resistance is standing out. And if I say I'm resisting the resistance, it's just...
So now I'm going to go back into this thing. Oh, I don't want to do that. No, I'm not. I'm not going to go back into it. Okay, in this moment, go to your true home. You know it's not in the argument. We argue ourselves outside of our true home, don't we? Go where the heart desperately longs to abide. See, that's following the deepest level of our intentionality. And sometimes skillful means like labeling has an appropriate place. I don't want to take away skillful means. But to always know that we're just adding another dimension of reflection within skillful means to help us kind of square ourselves with the energy of what we couldn't do. And so then eventually it's to abide, not to constantly use skillful means so that we note everything. It has a point and a point purpose, but then we move on with it. To abide.
So kind of on the powerless piece?
Powerless piece.
So my brother's about to go overseas.
Yes, powerless. Yes.
This huge process of accepting.
Yes.
And, my mind's gone everywhere from I'm going to kidnap him and take him to Canada.
Right.
To I'm going to protest at the White House.
Right.
To
right.
I'm going to, advocate for Obama. To
right.
Whatever. Every possible scenario.
Right. Right. Yes. Yes.
And it being incredibly painful.
Yes. Yes.
At some point, coming to a very clear understanding that I have zero control.
Yes, good.
Over the situation.
Yes, good.
The train is in motion.
That's right, good.
There's nothing I can do about it.
That's right. So this is no longer should not be happening. When you're powerless, when you're powerless, is powerlessness is not resignation.
No, I've actually got a good chunk of freedom. Right,
yes, now. Good.
It doesn't change the fact that you're knowing and that horrible things could happen.
That's right.
I've got letting go of it being my responsibility.
Yes, good, perfect.
Incredibly
freeing.
Yeah.
Very good. So the essence is to understand that the knee-jerk, rebellious reaction of the self is to clamp down and say, this is not okay. This should not be happening. I mean, if we can just open up a little bit and say it is happening. I mean, I don't care what, you can yell and scream about the justice of it, and that's a separate point. That's really a separate point. Yell and scream about why we are in Iraq and all of that. That's a separate point. But the point of this is that what is happening. To yell and scream about that fact and say that it shouldn't be really doesn't do a thing to alter the fact, does it? Right? So the question, and the one that is much deeper, is can I be most effective acceding to the fact that it is happening than I can be in holding an arrogance and a righteousness that it shouldn't be? Is my effort, is my energy, is my alignment much more harmonious and therefore probably much more, and have much more ability to serve when I'm not in argument? It doesn't mean you think it's right that the Vietnam War or the Iraq War is going on or anything. It's not acceding your points, your political points. It's simply realizing that reality has only one disposition and it cannot be altered. And therefore, when we align ourselves with the unalterable position of that disposition without regret and without resignation, we are most effective in our actions from that alignment, because that alignment is the alignment of interconnectedness, not hostility. And so then, I don't know what happens out of that will be individually determined, but it could look something like, let me connect with my brother and what he must be going through, rather than being angry at the political forces that sent him there. How does he feel about this? And maybe he wants to go. I mean, what is the, you see, is this just my issue? Or, you see, it just takes us right on through. Right on through. Yes.
You mentioned about making it unconscious conscious, and I was curious. I sometimes start building stories when I'm trying to do that. I was wondering if there's another thing you're getting at there.
Yes, how to make the unconscious conscious. Well, we start, and we have the every intention of doing that when we have mindfulness, right? We are directing our, the one thing we have, which is our awareness, towards seeing ourself. And so we're kind of opening up behind the curtains. We've always been out front stage, been a puppet to what it is behind the curtain. Now we're turning back in and opening up the curtain to see what it is that's been pulling our cords, right? And we see everything that we thought was so hideous and hellish isn't. That this whole mechanism of stage presentation, production, and all of that has, I can make it conscious, so that I no longer have to stand out there. It's now everything is exposed. So it looks like, so mindfulness is the ability to sort of direct our attention to expose backstage presentation. The problem with mindfulness is that it's like looking through a porthole. The picture is only partial. If we're honest, because we're judging all around the porthole, and we're only seeing, and that porthole has a glass in it, it's all, you know, it's, we're not really seeing as clearly as we could. And we keep trying to, and we keep trying, you know, and every time we make that kind of forced attempt to even be more mindful, We get more frustrated in our inability to be continuous, and so the whole thing gets very funny. At that point, and this is the point that she was making, Rachel, and that is that I see I'm powerless to clear this glass up, to make it any more conscious. Now I just have to say, I have to change my faith from the faith in making myself the operator of choice and making myself conscious, to just being willing to stop resisting where I'm unconscious. I don't have to steer this boat. I just have to be able to give up where I'm already keeping it at bay. Where am I resisting it? See? So then the question becomes, let me look at where I'm resisting. Where is there an edge to myself? Let me look at where I'm not relaxed, where the tension is, where I'm saying no to life. All the different ways, we can make it very simple. It doesn't have to be complex. And it certainly isn't brought out on, you know, with years and years. It's just the willingness to say, okay, I got it now, so let me just relax. Let me look at it. And as we relax more and more, the porthole gets bigger, the glass gets bright and clear, and we begin to see more and more and more and more and more. Not through our efforts, but through our relaxation and willingness to do so. And that's as far as we can go tonight.